Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lou Wolf, co-founder and publisher of Covert Action Quarterly, who examines how the recent terror attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C. could have bypassed U.S. intelligence. Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University, who discusses the potential for indiscriminate violence inherent in the Bush administration's stated intentions following the September 11th assaults. And Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine, who summarizes a widely endorsed interdenominational religious statement calling for a faith-based response to terrorism. But first, we begin with a visit to New York City's Union Square, where thousands of people spontaneously gathered to pray, light candles, and generally try to cope with the September 11th terror attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Scott Harris files this special report.
There are people of almost every race, religion, and creed on this patch of green in busy Lower Manhattan, just a short distance away from the still smoldering ruins of the landmark World Trade Center. There are those who came here to post photos of missing relatives and friends. Others came to pray and sing with each other, light candles, write messages on rolls of paper draped over fences, or debate about what America should do to respond to the recent attacks. Under the trees and near the base of a large statue of George Washington riding a horse, small and large groups of people conducted heated but mostly civil discussions about the cause of terrorism and what America's role in the world has been and should be.
But are they supporting these people?
They are. They should be removed. That's okay. Not the point.
But how do you do that?
Ken Curtis of Queens, New York, described the scene at Union Square as one massive open-air therapy session.
Look at this. We're all here honoring these people that died in these terrorist acts. We're all here honoring these people. I mean, I've never seen anything like this before. And why does it take this kind of act to bring us together? Look at these people. There's black, there's white, there's Asian, there's Christians, there's Jews, there's Muslims, all mingling here, all feeling the same feelings. Why does it take something like this to have brought us all together?
What course of action do you think the United States should take? There are polls that say people in this country, given the violence done to us, are willing to take other innocent people's lives in order to get at the perpetrators. Do you think that's the right course of action?
I'm not, you know, and I think that's part of the nature of what's going on here. I don't think that any one person here has the answer. I asked that man before, you know, give me a how, and he couldn't, because I don't believe there is any one how we go about this. I would prefer that we don't have to engage innocent people in this. I would prefer that we have a clear-cut enemy and we can go after that enemy and, you know, do away with that enemy. But unfortunately, the people that we're dealing with have hidden themselves away in a terrain of a country that's so unbelievably difficult to get to that I believe there's probably going to be innocent people who are going to be victims of this. And it's very unfortunate, very unfortunate. Do I think it's right? No. Do I think we're going to end up doing it? I think that that's going to happen.
On the morning of September 11th, Andrew Fitanides emerged from the subway one block from the World Trade Center just after the first plane struck Tower 1, exploding into a horrifying fireball. He managed to leave the area before the eventual collapse of both skyscrapers. Fitanides was one of hundreds of those who participated in the extraordinary debates taking place at Union Square.
For all of us, you know, who witnessed this or who even were in the city and experienced this terrible tragedy, all of us are thinking, how to make America safe? What can we do to protect this land that we love and to keep it the kind of nation where the freedoms that we cherish and hold so dearly are going to be maintained? And I don't think anybody has the answers right now, but what I've been trying to do through emails and through conversations with friends and through talking to people here is to encourage people to not act out of their feelings and not act out of vengeance, but instead to try to think what we can do as a people to eliminate this problem if we can, or to reduce it, or to get to the root of what causes this kind of terrible tragedy to take place.
A lot of people don't want to even think about causes right now. They want to They want retaliation, and they want blood. They want to exact a pound of flesh for the suffering that's going on here. How do we as a country, you think, deal with that effectively?
I think it's a big challenge for the maturity of our nation, of our political process, and specifically of our leaders, to not act out of the heart. Well, to act out of the better side of the heart and not act on vengeance, because as much as I feel the horror of what happened, as much as part of me really does want to strike back and do something violent and terrible to the people who did this, I've gone through waves where I felt like, you know, that had to be done, and I've been with the people here wanting to just strike out randomly and cause pain, that because pain was caused to me. But I mean, ultimately, I guess what I feel as a former Peace Corps volunteer, as somebody who's seen poverty firsthand, I understand that the desperation that those people exhibited comes from conditions of abject poverty. It comes from a country that's been at war for 23 years, with armies running across it backwards and forwards, and these regimes can only exist in a situation of absolute chaos. That kind of fundamentalism is really the last refuge of the human spirit. It's where you retreat when everything else has failed you, when all of your institutions are in rubble, when all of your infrastructure has been destroyed. It is only at that point that people are able to sacrifice themselves for what they believe is the only way of solving a problem which has gotten so intractable, so horrible, that the only way that you can envision it is to strike out and to cause other people pain so that they realize exactly how bad the situation they are in is. And, you know, for all the evil that this has done, it certainly has woken up America.
In the aftermath of the worst terror attack in U.S. history, what was occurring at Union Square and in many other cities across the country represented a collective effort to heal the wounds of this tragedy, the dimensions of which the nation is still trying to comprehend. For Between the Lines at Union Square in New York City, I'm Scott Harris.
On Tuesday morning, September 11th, America's sense of security was broadsided by terrorist assaults on the World Trade Center buildings in New York City, the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and in Pennsylvania. Thousands of people are reported missing, and hopes for finding survivors dwindles with each passing day. It was only weeks earlier that Osama bin Laden, President Bush's number one suspect, stated in an interview with Abdel Bari Atwan, editor of an Arab London newspaper, that there were plans for very, very big attacks against American interests. Many are posing the question, how did these attacks, which are carried out with almost pinpoint precision, get past U.S. intelligence? How did 19 extremists hijack 4 U.S. civilian airliners and use them to destroy 2 of our nation's most important economic and political symbols? The U.S. spends nearly $30 billion annually on intelligence, but wasn't able to stop the annihilation of thousands of innocent civilians on that fateful day. Lew Wolf is the co-founder and publisher of Covert Action Quarterly. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about the apparent failure of U.S. intelligence agencies.
I am very disturbed by one thing I just learned of, that one senior Bush administration official, not named, was quoted on C-SPAN speaking to the issue of the war that the U.S. has declared. They're calling it a war. I mean, we haven't declared war ever since World War II. All the wars that the United States has been involved in since then have been unofficial wars. But the point was that this senior Bush administration official said this war could last as long as 10 years into the second Bush administration. Those were his words. Now think about that. They're already thinking in terms of the very base political terms, that this is a political gambit, it seems, which some of us have thought from the very beginning, that this was not necessarily an event that had been conducted by the United States, but now that it had happened, it's very, very disturbing when you hear that the administration talks about this in terms of a second Bush administration.
What is your response to those that say this may be a result of U.S. policy throughout the Middle East?
If that is the case, it does not justify anyone carrying out something, an operation of this nature.
You know, Osama bin Laden has been tagged as the culprit in this, and he may very well be. But as publisher of the Covert Action Quarterly, what issues will you be addressing in your publication? Do you think that he may be behind this?
He may very well be behind it, although I think the government is obligated to present its evidence, and I say evidence as opposed to statements that to the effect that they know this to be so. A lot points in his direction, there's no question about it. What I regard as a knee-jerk reaction to go after Osama bin Laden here, while I think he's a very, very scary person, and he has a long history of involvement with terrorism, I should point out that he got his start in this business on the payroll of the United States government, of the CIA. In our view here, however, this operation required so much more input than either one man or one umbrella of an organization of his size could have put together. I think it required, and I won't go into the logistics and the planning and the intelligence that was required for this, it leads one to wonder if there wasn't some other kind of involvement. And I'm not alleging here anything except to say that I don't, just like Lee Harvey Oswald could not have carried out the assassination of John F. Kennedy on his own, just as Timothy McVeigh could not have done what he did in Oklahoma City, it does seem to me that Osama bin Laden could not have done this, even if he had 50 people, as they say now, involved in the operation. This is much bigger than that. I mean, it does beg the question as to how much help they had.
Some people are claiming that there was a gap in U.S. intelligence for this to happen, and that it just seemingly came out of nowhere. But yet, in a few days, the Bush administration was claiming that they had proof of who organized this attack.
I should remind listeners also that there had been security alerts called by the State Department. Ostensibly, they were saying their intelligence indicated that there might be attacks in Rome or in Paris. Those were the two cities that were named. And American travelers were advised of this several weeks before September 11th. Of course, it's certainly a stretch from that to predict, even if you have a crystal ball that has vast capabilities, what could have been planned. They're blaming this on the fact that the CIA doesn't, they say, have enough people inside terrorist organizations. I should remind people, at the time of the first attack on the World Trade Center in New York, and back in 1993, they did have an informant, a major informant, right inside the organization. That informant was present during the planning for the bombing, where they placed a truck bomb in the basement in the parking garage of the Trade Tower, attempting to accomplish exactly what was accomplished this past week. And they even had videotapes of the preparations for it, of the explosives being prepared. It was an FBI informant inside the organization, and this has come out during the grand jury and the trial in New York. Nobody has questioned the fact that U.S. intelligence, in this case the FBI, had advanced knowledge of the plan to bomb the World Trade Center, and yet they let it go ahead. You have to ask why.
That was Lou Wolf, co-founder and publisher of Covert Action Quarterly. For more information, call area code 202-331-9753 or visit the website www.covertactionquarterly.org. In the wake of the cataclysmic events, the Bush administration has promised the public that the government is organizing massive military retaliation against the perpetrators amid vows to root out evil, and in the words of Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, ending states who sponsor terrorism, a statement later retracted. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joy Gordon, an attorney and professor of philosophy at Fairfield University in Connecticut, who specializes in the study of ethics and human rights. She discusses the potential for indiscriminate violence inherent in the Bush administration's response, the viewpoint that creates a hierarchy of value regarding human life, and the recent tragedy in light of America's past history of human rights abuses.
It's particularly frightening to hear that sort of language used, because when we talk about ending states, if what that means is some sort of massive bombing against an entire nation as a whole, the language that we would use for that ordinarily is genocide. Genocide is the indiscriminate obliteration of an entire people, essentially because they're there, because that's who they are. And that's exactly what offends us most deeply about the bombings, the attacks on the World Trade Center as well. It's that people were killed simply for being American, simply for being in New York or being in Washington, when the attacks were a response to policies of particular government leaders. It's the notion of collective responsibility. It's the idea of punishing an entire people for the acts of particular members. It can be said that the U.S. is not a particular stranger to the notion of collective responsibility. Certainly it's something that we feel very vividly right now, but it's also a notion that we've employed in other circumstances. Economic sanctions are perhaps one of the most clear examples of that. So in the case of Iraq, the United States government considers Saddam Hussein to have committed human rights violations and to have been responsible for aggression and so on. And we hear language such as Saddam Hussein is just like Hitler. Yet economic sanctions are penalties that are imposed upon the nation as a whole. The UNICEF figures at this point are that something on the order of 500,000 children under five in Iraq are dead as a result of sanctions, and that's primarily from waterborne diseases. So there's this notion of punishing the Iraqi people as a whole, and that the punishment is a response to the policies or the acts of particular leaders such as Saddam Hussein. If we look at other situations, the U.S. has often employed a notion of collective responsibility in others as well. What comes to mind is the arrest of Noriega in Panama City, and the notion that because we considered Noriega to be a criminal that we wanted to prosecute here, we sought to arrest him, and the form of the arrest was an invasion of the country of Panama militarily. There's a fair amount of film footage, and there's certainly extensive documentation of the result of that, which was indiscriminate blanket bombing of extensive civilian areas in the city of Panama. The estimates on those that seem the most reliable are somewhere between 4,000 and 7,000 civilians in Panama were killed in the blanket bombing, and an entire residential area was simply wiped out. The numbers 4,000 to 7,000 are general numbers. There wasn't the capacity to identify with precision how many there were, because the bodies were bulldozed into mass graves by the U.S. military on the grounds that if they were allowed to remain, they would present a public health problem. You can imagine now how that would seem in New York City when we look at how much the extraordinary efforts that are being gone to so that people can know for certain if their friends and family were among the dead in the World Trade Center.
Talk a little bit, as a philosopher and someone who's very involved with teaching and studying ethics and international ethics, the value of a life, the value of an American life, that Americans put on American life versus the value of lives of people in other countries.
Well, I'm reminded of the language from, I think it was Curtis LeMay in the Vietnam War, something along the lines of the Vietnamese don't value life the way we do. In a sense, Curtis LeMay was right, which is to say they value their own lives as being fully human. They have a sense of their children, their parents, their families, as being lives of enormous value. We treat those, whatever we say, as being of lives of far lower value, and we treat our own lives as being of absolute value.
What is a possible ethical or legal framework to move forward from here and achieve justice?
Well, I think the legal framework is a terribly important question. Because the language that's being used is not so much the language of law, it's the language of eradicating evil and eradicating terrorism. In philosophy, we don't really believe in the notion of eradicating evil. We think that evil is part of the human condition. I can only sort of imagine what it might look like concretely to say that you're eradicating evil, and that seems to be some sort of indiscriminate wanton destruction. the term for that that we have is genocide. And there is no known justification for genocide. Under international law, that's not something that ever has a justification. Genocide is not justified by the claim of retaliation. It's not justified by the claim of deterrence. There is no such thing as justified genocide. Yet that seems to be more or less what's being talked about is what our next course of action will be.
That was Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University. Her book on the ethics of economic sanctions against Iraq is forthcoming from Harvard University Press. As the nation attempted to come to grips with the enormity of the loss of life and massive destruction wrought by the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., some on the religious right used the occasion to say that the sins of some Americans were responsible for the attack. Television evangelists Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who spoke on the Christian Broadcast Network's 700 Club program, stated that homosexuals, feminists, abortion rights supporters, and civil liberties groups bear some of the blame for the September 11th terror assaults. President Bush, who received significant support from Falwell and Robertson in last year's presidential election, described the remarks as inappropriate. But a broad coalition of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim clergy responded to the tragedy in a very different way. More than 500 progressive religious leaders thus far have signed onto a statement titled, "Deny Them Their Victory, a Religious Response to Terrorism." Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine, who summarizes the statement he helped draft and his concerns as America and the world enter a new and dangerous era.
This is a time that it's like no other time that most of us have ever known. It's going to change us in profound ways. It already is. And as religious leaders, a lot of us felt we needed some kind of word being spoken. And you saw on your television sets and the radio all of the services on Saturday and Sunday and then the services on Friday. And the religious community certainly has a role to play, as we did, I think, in trying to comfort this deep, deep grief and mourn for those who are dead and bring us together. But I think also that our own traditions in the religious community have to help us find a response. We face some deep and profound questions about what this attack will do to us as a nation. And the statement we just sent out a few days ago, it's gotten just hundreds of signatures now, Muslims, Jews, Catholics, Protestants, black and white Christians. It says, "The terrorists have offered us a stark view of the world they would create, where the remedy to every human grievance and injustice is a resort to the random and cowardly violence of revenge, even against the most innocent. Having taken thousands of our lives, attacked our national symbols, forced our political leaders to flee their chambers of governance, disrupted our work and families, and struck fear in the hearts of our children, the terrorists must feel victorious. But we can deny them their victory by refusing to submit to a world created in their image." And it talks about how this must not drive us away from being the people that we've been called to be, that we have to assert the vision of community and tolerance and compassion and justice and the sacredness of human life, which lies at the heart of our traditions. Most of us believe these people should be brought to justice, but that speaks of the rule of law. And what I'm most concerned about, many of us are, is that out of anger or revenge, which I understand completely, that there'd be indiscriminate violence against innocent lives. And as one woman said on TV the other night, she said, "President Bush, don't spread our pain. We've seen the pain. Don't spread our pain." This is a time, a short window perhaps, where we have to raise a voice to our political leaders to say, let us not become part of the evil that we loathe. Let us not become like those who have done this to us. Let us respond in a different kind of way. Sure and certain, and those who have done this must be brought to justice. But I don't want the children of Kabul bombed because of what happened to the New York World Trade Tower. So that's my concern in the statement. All we're doing is trying to raise a voice for a response that reflects our best values as a people and doesn't resort to sometimes our worst instincts.
In that statement, Jim Wallace, there was talk of a test for our national character. I wondered if you would elaborate on that. What is the test, do you think, that we're being put through at this moment?
Well, I think you know, terrorism inflicts not only death and destruction, but also emotional oppression to further its aims. And in one sense, these are people trying to create a world in their own image. And if we respond to them in kind, if we, I saw a young teenage kid on television yesterday say, I don't want to be like them, you know, I don't want to act like them. And I think we have a chance to show that we have better values than that. We, you know, this nation, like all nations, we have our best selves and our worst selves. And this is a time that can call out either one, call out what is the best in us and what is the worst. And I think the stronger response to deny them their victory, if we just respond in kind, we are, in fact, giving them a victory. I don't want them to win this. I want what they vision for the world to lose. And I want to win with some better values. So I'm hoping that this test of our national character will drive us to, I'm telling everybody, you know, it's time to dig deep into our best moral, spiritual, religious values and find out who we really are as a people.
That was Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine. Contact Sojourners by calling area code 202-328-8842 or visit their website at www.sojo.net. We wish to extend our deepest condolences to the families of the victims who so tragically lost their lives on Tuesday, September 11th, and to all those who are suffering as a result of our nation's recent violent catastrophe. We trust that the global community will come together to work for peace and justice, to stop the cycle of violence, and create a safer world for our children and the generations to come. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.